there is no end to the problems. That we as a nation face extraordinarily significant problems, from global warming to Iraq to the economy to media reform to education to broadband growth, even to copyright. But we will not address these problems sensibly until we solve this first problem, our own alcoholism, our own dependency, a dependency on the way money has corrupted this government. As Josh Silver reminded us, it's not a new problem. It's just a new moment. It's a moment of extraordinary hope when we can change many things, but change this as well. Thank you very much.
Lawrence Lessig, Stanford Law Professor and founder of the Center for Internet and Society, speaking this weekend at the National Conference on Media Reform in Minneapolis. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, KWMD Kasilof Anchorage, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, WUOW Oneonta, KRBS Oroville, WKNH Keene, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, KSOW Cottage Grove, or WMRW Warren. We return to more audio from the National Conference on Media Reform.
Our first speaker tonight is Tim Wu. Tim is a professor at Columbia Law School and famously coined the term net neutrality, a mark of celebrity to geeks far and wide. He's a... Yeah, geeks! Woo!
Oh, welcome!
Calm down, dude. Tim's a writer for Slate and recently penned an article in the New Yorker magazine. He's also the co-author of Who Controls the Internet and has too many degrees and prestigious awards to name here. This year, he takes the baton from Robert McChesney as the chair of Free Press Board of Directors. Also, I got drunk in his apartment a few weeks ago in New York. Please give it up for Tim Wu.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. It's something to be introduced by Veritunde. He actually showed up at a party at my house a few weeks ago in New York, and it's quite a shock to meet him here in the green room again. I thought I would never see the end of him at that party. Anyway, I want to say welcome and hello to everybody in the Free Press family. This is my first conference as the new chair of Free Press, and I am just incredibly honored and thrilled to take that position. I can't start this without saying, first of all, thanks and incredible gratitude to the work that Bob McChesney has done as my predecessor, and I want to just... And that goes also to the staff of Free Press, to the board of Free Press, to the Free Press Action Board. They have built an incredible organization with an incredible membership that, to my mind, and just looking at this audience, has proved one thing beyond doubt, that in this area, media reform, political apathy is dead. There is just no... It's not completely dead. But when I look at this group, you are the physical evidence that apathy in the area of media reform is just over. Now, I want to talk a little bit about what I see as the mission of Free Press going forward. But first of all, I just want to talk about why I'm so excited to take the chairmanship of this board at this time. It's very clear to me that we are in a special time for the topic of media reform. You know, issues have their eras. Issues have their moments when they start to matter and become pressing and become demanding and become so obvious that something must be done. In the 1920s, this was civil liberties, when the ACLU was founded and first began to ask what sort of civil liberties needed to be defended for Americans. There's other examples like environmentalism in the 1970s, when people started to first ask, what exactly are we doing to this planet? It is very clear to me now in the 2000s that the topic of media reform, the subject, the problem of private control and private abuse of the media, is the issue whose time has come. Now, what I wanted to speak about today are the twin focuses of the Free Press organization, and speak a little bit about how they are linked. Free Press spends most of its time on two, what I think of as very important issues: the issue of media consolidation and the issue of internet freedom. I think for a lot of the members of Free Press, the issue of media consolidation in some ways is a more obvious and straightforward issue. We know what it means when the media is owned by two or three or four gigantic entities. It's very obvious why that is a danger to journalism, to free expression, to the very democracy that is the founding principle of the United States. But some of these internet freedom issues, I think, may strike some of our members as less clear what exactly they're all about. You may read in our, no doubt, numerous email messages, which we all get, about things like Comcast blocking content, about the issue of network neutrality. And some of you may wonder, what exactly is this all about, or even why should I care? Why does this matter? So I want to explain why I think these issues of media consolidation and internet freedom are similar issues and what precisely they have in common. This is what I want to stress first and foremost: that the issues that Free Press deals with are fundamentally the challenges and the problems from abuse of private power. The United States has many strong points in its design, but one of the problems the United States has had and will always have is the abuse of private power. And when we fight these internet freedom issues, and I'll talk about them more later, we are dealing with the fact that an increasingly small number of companies, telephone and cable companies, are in a position where they are carrying, examining, moving almost all of American speech. Think about how much of our speech, whether it's political, whether it's entertainment, cultural, moves on the internet today, and realize that there are fewer and fewer and fewer entities who have the power to control what goes through and what is the internet. And that is why internet freedom, to begin with, is so closely related to these issues of media consolidation. It is about the question, the oldest question in politics: who will guard the gatekeepers? Who will make sure that the gatekeepers are public servants as opposed to entities designing to enriching themselves, interfering with politics, and ruining what the internet is supposed to be? Now, let me say this by moving it back a little bit, this problem of private power, and talking about the United States Constitution. The United States Constitution is a magnificent document, survived, well, at least couple of decades before the Civil War, but it has a few weaknesses. The founders were obsessed with a problem they saw before them, and that was the abuse of public power by the king. They saw very clearly that they needed to set up safeguards to prevent the government from becoming a dictatorship. But the problem with the Constitution is that it wasn't clear at the time, and it wasn't fully understood, the degree to which this would become a unified economy and the degree to which private power would become as much a threat to this country as abuses of public power. The Bill of Rights is a very powerful document. It has some of the most important American freedoms in it, but it has no protection whatsoever against private power. The First Amendment does not apply to Walmart. The First Amendment does not defend you when your employer prevents you from speaking, when your internet provider prevents you from speaking, when the media prevent you from speaking. And so in this country, we need alternative mechanisms to control private power. It falls to organizations. It falls to three types of entity. It falls like to organizations, Free Press being an example of it. It falls to the media. And it falls to citizens to do what they can to control the abuses of private power which are possible. But you can understand the threat. If the media is designed to be the check on private power, if private power takes over the media, there's no check left. It's the same problem you have when you have one party that is in control of every branch of government. The system of checks and balances cannot work when one party controls every branch of government. This would be very clear any time of history you want to talk about, not only the last 8 years. And similarly, if private power controls the media, the system of checks and balances no longer works. The system of controlling private power is gone if the private power is controlling the media. And this, I want to stress to you, is the reason for Free Press's existence. The abuses and the problems we have seen are the reasons you are here today and are the reasons I'm so excited to be chairman of this organization.
Tim Wu, Columbia University law professor and incoming chair of the board of Free Press. He's co-author of Who Controls the Internet?
Federal Communications Commissioner Michael J. Copps. Yes. He's one of the most powerful voices for the public interest in the history of the FCC. During his 7 years at the agency, he has not only stood up against media consolidation, he has stood firmly with the media reform movement every step of the way. Many would say he has elevated the role to that of rock star status. That's right, notices of proposed rulemaking are hot now, y'all, because of this guy. Common carrier rules, hot. So please, a nice warm welcome from Michael Copps. Come on out, Commissioner.
I like the way she does her job, don't you? Thank you all, and thank you, Free Press, for showing America what an honest-to-God grassroots conference looks like. You guys are democracy at its best. It's been quite a year, hasn't it? Pentagon propaganda campaigns, NARAL text messages blocked, Pearl Jam censored, cable giants using reset packages to manage BitTorrent, the internet racing down the same road to consolidated control as radio and TV, Sam Zell gobbling up Tribune, the FCC refusing even to look at the legality of Rupert Murdoch adding the Wall Street Journal to his media empire, all the while we hand out permission slips to consolidate like they were candy on Halloween. Isn't it time for a change? Here's the good news. The winds of change are blowing across America. Reform is coming to Washington, D.C., and my goal is to make media reform one of the very first out of the gate. Sure, comprehensive media reform will take some time. There is a lot of damage to be undone. But I say we do something meaningful and achievable right off the bat, and I call it a down payment on media democracy. And my down payment has two parts. One is better TV and radio. Public airwaves has been an oxymoron for too long. These are the people's airwaves. The people's airwaves. And the American people make a bargain. Broadcasters get to use the public airwaves worth billions for free. And in return, we the people get programming aimed a little higher than the bottom line, or at least that's what we're supposed to get. You getting a lot of that these days? Once upon a time, the FCC actually enforced this bargain. We looked at a station's performance every 3 years and then decided whether to renew its license. We had real public interest guidelines. That's all gone. Now we renew licenses every 8 years, and the only thing we look for is where to put the FCC rubber stamp. It is time to put a cop back on the beat. Broadcasters need to think twice before running one more infomercial on Sunday morning, bumping that local public affairs program. Don't get me wrong. A lot of broadcasters want to do the right thing. But we make their jobs harder, not easier, when we let the bad apples off the hook. I am here to say with you, no more free rides. And let's try that one together. No more free rides. The down payment on media democracy will provide meaningful review every 3 years with clear guidelines on how broadcasters must serve their local, underline local, communities. And the down payment will put stations that ignore the public interest on probation. And I'll tell you this. A station on probation will get serious about serving the public interest real damn fast. But if it doesn't, then it'll be goodbye license. Let's try that one together, too. Goodbye license. We'll give it to someone who has a personal interest in the public interest. The other pillar of my down payment on media democracy is the internet freedom that Tim Wu talked about. If you want to blog about local politics, do you really have to pay some huge gatekeeper for every reader you get? Should anyone be telling you what you can read and see and hear on the internet, which applications you can run, which devices you can use? The down payment is a clear and enforceable principle of non-discrimination at the FCC. AT&T agreed to this principle when it bought Bell South, and AT&T doesn't seem to have suffered too much from it, has it? But that commitment expires at the end of this year, and it's time that we had a net neutrality principle that applies to all gatekeepers, all the time, real network neutrality. That's a heavy lift. It's a heavy lift against powerful interests, that's true. But that never deterred this crowd before. It didn't deter us when Michael Powell tried to decimate our media ownership rules a few years ago. Together, we put the kibosh on that. It was your energy that kept hope alive when insiders told us we were wasting our time trying to make net neutrality an issue. It is your tireless work that has dragged these crucial debates from behind closed industry doors into the sunshine of national debate. And it is your support, your dedication to our democracy that gets me out of bed each day and inspires me to fight for the public interest. On a night like tonight, with all the energy and commitment in this room, almost anything seems possible, doesn't it? And to tell you the truth, I feel like that a lot these days. I know that we can get this done. We can climb into the broad uplands of real democracy, because as we change the media, we change everything. We empower 300 million Americans to deal with all those issues that big media has dumbed down or just plain ignored at terrible, terrible cost to our democracy. There is no real democracy without media democracy. So tonight, moving forward in hope, let us move forward in a mutual pledge to get that down payment and then to push on to the final installment. Commissioner Adelstein and I will be doing everything we can. Byron Dorgan and Mike Doyle will be doing everything they can. But what really makes it happen is you, all of you here tonight, your friends, your neighbors, that third grade classmate you run into at the supermarket, the candidates you meet, and you should go out of your way in these critical months to meet candidates and ask all these people to support the down payment on media democracy. Tell it, as Bill Moyers challenged us so eloquently, so movingly this morning. Tell it everywhere you go. That is the road for us to travel. That is the road to victory. And when we get it, and get it we will trace our victory back here to Minneapolis on this glorious night. So let me ask you, can we do this? Yes, we can. Thank you.
FCC Commissioner Michael Copps.
2008 Free Press Hall of Shame, where we honor the best of the worst America has to offer in media, democracy, and your right to free speech. The 2008 Hall of Shame nominees for Worst Corporation are Verizon, they got caught blocking text messages from this pro-choice group, sparking a joint condemnation in the Washington Post from both pro-choice and pro-life groups. They don't agree on much, but they agree on this one. Our next Hall of Shame nominee, cable giant Comcast. They got caught blocking web traffic in BitTorrent Gate. Then paid people off the street to fill seats at a public hearing to block real citizens from getting in.
Honestly, I'm just getting paid to hold somebody's seat. Yeah. I don't even know what's going on.
They're a current frontrunner in Consumerist's Worst Company in America contest for 2008, spawning legions of customer hate groups and videos. Comcast must die! Next up, big media behemoth Viacom. For telling writers it was too soon to put a dollar value on digital content, while telling others it was actually worth millions.
Viacom will double its revenues this year from digital.
And the 2008 Shamey for Worst Corporation goes to AT&T. America broke up the AT&T monopoly in 1984, but AT&T is back, baby. And it helped the NSA set up a secret room at AT&T's central office to help the Bush administration illegally spy on Americans.
Some telecom companies will break multiple laws to help the government spy on you because they love America and freedom so much. Unless the government stops paying them to spy, then they'll disconnect spy service. After all, freedom isn't free.
No, it isn't. And America did pay. And pay some more, soaring AT&T to record profits. CEO Big Ed stepped down last year with one of the biggest retirement packages in history, $150 million. And new CEO Randall Stephenson is continuing AT&T's winning ways. He plans to gut net neutrality once and for all. AT&T, your world delivered to them.
The next speaker is U.S. Senator Byron Dorgan from North Dakota.
Thank you so much. I'm a little overdressed tonight. I've been traveling all day in North Dakota, and I saw on the internet that there was a sinister group of people meeting in Minneapolis, Minnesota, for the purpose of taking back their government. And I thought, that's where I want to be. You know? It's a kind of a dangerous thing, isn't it, this people power? Kind of a dangerous thing to the interests that sort of have things going their way. So I'm really pleased to be here. Jonathan didn't mention that I come from a ranching town of about 300 people. We raised cattle and horses. I graduated in a high school senior class of 9 and was in the top 5. And you laugh, but my parents were proud and it qualified me to run for the United States Senate. And so here I are. Let me tell you, this quilt work of democracy is really interesting, but it needs nourishment and refreshment from time to time, and we have so many issues, it's unbelievable. The war, health care, energy, gas and oil prices, terrorism, unemployment, the list is endless. But I want to talk to you tonight about the media. What do we know? What do we know about all of these things, and how do we know it? Who tells us? You know, we're a country of about 300 million people, and we get our information every single day from, quote, the media, unquote. So what is it? Newspapers? Radio? Television? Cable? In most cases, owned by big interests that have nothing to do or no connection to the local area. That's a fact. And it seems to me irrefutable that most of what we see, hear, and read every day in this country is increasingly controlled and determined by about 6 major corporations in this country. And that's something we have to change. Some might say, well, so what? So what? Well, they say there are more internet sites, there's hundreds of cable channels, so what? And I have said over and over again, as Jonathan said, yes, I agree there are more voices from the same ventriloquist. And that is the problem that we have to fix. Now, if you doubt this issue, and you don't, but some do, if they doubt this issue, let me take them back to Natalie Maines in England at a concert with the Dixie Chicks. And here is what she said. Here is what she said. Listen carefully. Just so you know, quote, just so you know, we are ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas, unquote. Just so you know, we are ashamed the President of the United States is from Texas. That, by the way, is called free speech. And for that, the music of this band, this group, that has sold 36 million albums, was boycotted and banned. And almost immediately by 1,400 radio stations. But you know what? Those 1,400 radio stations that banned their music were owned by 2 companies. Doesn't that tell you something? And then rallying the tractorcades to get the tractors out the modern day version of the book burning to get the CDs and the Dixie Chick memorabilia to run over it with giant tractors, and then ratcheting up such emotion that they actually had death threats. You know, this is not about three singers. This, after all, is about free speech in a great democracy. If that doesn't concern you, it's 2 a.m. in the morning, and the largest chemical spill in the history of America occurs in Minot, North Dakota. Anhydrous ammonia cars explode, leave the railroad tracks, one 500 feet into the air. A deadly plume envelops this town of Minot, North Dakota. We were so fortunate. Only one person died, but about 1,600 people eventually sought medical treatment. Six commercial radio stations in Minot, North Dakota, all playing homogenized music out of a box coming 1,400 miles from there. And they couldn't find anybody at home at the radio stations to broadcast the news of the largest chemical spill in this country. Do you think maybe if those radio stations had been owned locally by six different people, they'd have gotten somebody out of bed because they knew the people that owned them? Now, there was a time when it was different, very different. Some people say, well, that's kind of hokey, that's old-fashioned. There was a time when the local radio station would broadcast the local high school basketball game and the Junior Legion baseball game and advertise what the charities were going to do in that town the next weekend. There was a time when the newspaper was owned locally and people knew the publisher. There was a time when, in order to get a license to broadcast television or radio, you had to meet certain public interest standards, and you had to meet standards with respect to localism. Those days are gone, and the virtues of serving your hometown have gone with it, regrettably. And so now we're served this homogenized junk. Music we hardly recognize, a playlist designed by somebody 1,000 miles away. Now, let me tell you, I watched one of our networks on television a while back, and there was a helicopter that was keeping its camera on a sheriff's car taking Paris Hilton to jail. And man, did they cover that. And the word crawl on the bottom of the screen was telling me that Mr. Putin over in Russia was ratcheting up great tension with us about missiles in Eastern Europe. But the picture was about Paris Hilton going to jail. Tells you a little something, doesn't it? About this infotainment and what they're providing us these days. The Pope died. When the Pope died, Larry King had the man who played Jesus in The Passion of Christ on as a guest. Well, if you can't get the real, you know, he had on Jim. He had on Jim. And let me tell you something. I swear to you this happened. You can go back and get the clip. They were about ready to break for a commercial. And it was a solemn moment because the Pope had died. And Larry King turned to Jim and said, Jim, do you think the Pope is with Jesus now? We have only 30 seconds. I thought, you know what? That kind of spells it all out for me. Well, let me tell you, we have only 30 seconds. Let me tell you, we've got a lot of work to do. You've seen two Federal Communication Commissioners tonight who are first rate. I really appreciate the work they do. And let me also say to you that this organization, Free Press, and all the groups you belong to, deciding that, you know what, we can do something about this. We don't have to accept this. We can change this. I am so inspired by that. Now, let me tell you something. A few years ago, Michael Powell was chair of the Federal Communications Commission, and he decided to do a rule. So he did a rule. Here's what the rule was. After we've had this galloping concentration in virtually all of the media, he said, my new ownership rule is that in the largest American cities, the same company can own 8 radio stations, 3 television stations, the dominant newspaper, and the cable company, and it'll be just fine with him. That's unbelievable. And he passed that rule over the objections of Commissioner Copps and Commissioner Adelstein. And I used, for the first time in the history of the Senate, a little-known procedure that allowed us to do what was called a legislative veto. I authored a bill, and I went over and got Trent Lott. Wait a second. I got Trent Lott on the other side to join me. I wanted to appeal to the schizophrenics. And so I got... So Trent and I took this to the floor of the Senate, and we passed a bill on the floor of the Senate saying to the FCC, we veto your rule. Now... Federal Communications Commission did the same thing over the objection of the two commissioners you've heard tonight just months ago. And I took the same approach in the United States Senate, and I'm proud to tell you, once again, the United States Senate has said to the FCC, we veto your rule. Now, there's a great old Cherokee Indian chief who once said, the success of a rain dance depends a lot on timing. Well, you know, that is a wise old chief. Timing is everything. And this is a time to take these issues on. First of all, this issue of media concentration. Let's take it on. Let's restore ownership limits. Let's just not fight against bad things. Let's return policy to good things. Let's fight for new ownership limits that cares about diversity, about localism, that cares about public interest for a change. We can do all of that. Wouldn't it be radical if we said, you've got to have a newsroom. You want to run a radio station, you've got to have a newsroom. You have to care about the public interest. That's not radical. That's where we ought to restore ownership rules. We can do this. We can demand of Congress that this happen. Now, with due respect to Tim, who talked about net neutrality, I have been the leader in the Senate on net neutrality, and I'm proud to do it. The only time we've had a vote on it, we had a 10-10 tie vote in the Commerce Committee. But I call it Internet freedom, and I do that because I think we talk like twits. I honestly do. Now, look at the other side. Just look at the other side, you know. President Bush wants to cut down trees. He calls it healthy forests. He wants to pollute the air. He calls it clear skies. What do? We say, well, we've got a plan called net neutrality. Or we've got a plan on energy where renewable portfolio standard. You got to put 15% of your electric energy as for renewable. So renewable portfolio standard, right? We need to come up with better language. I'm sorry. We really do. We have debates about LIHEAP, and we have debates about SCHIP and RPS, and we just need better language. But even as we develop this better language, we understand, all of us do, that net neutrality, or what I call internet freedom, is unbelievably important. It just is. This internet is a wonderful thing. It's pretty unbelievable, frankly. But there are people who now have decided they want to be gatekeepers, and they want to have toll booths. Now, there's a big old company out there called Google. 10 years ago, let me tell you about Google. 10 years ago, Larry and Sergey moved from their dorm room to a garage with 8 employees because the advantage was the garage had a garage door opener. What an unbelievable accomplishment. 10 years ago, 2 college kids moved from a dorm room to a garage. Now the net valuation of that company exceeds the combination of General Motors, Ford Motors, and Coca-Cola together. Think of it. Now ask yourself this. What if there are a couple kids in a dorm room tonight, perhaps in Minneapolis, maybe in Bismarck, and they've got an idea? Will they ever get there? Will they ever get past those who really want to establish gates that require them to pay to get through the gate? The way the internet has worked and has always worked is open architecture, free internet. Anybody can go anywhere, anytime. That's the open architecture we must protect and preserve in the internet. And finally, I have just asked the General Accounting Office to do an investigation of what has happened to independent programming in the media in this country. It's dropped right off the cliff. What's wrong with having a diversity of voices? What about a better menu? And I'll expect to get that from the General Accounting Office at some point in the months ahead. Having said all of these things, this is a great country. You and I know it. It's a great country to be able to sit here. We've done all these things. We've split the atom. We've spliced genes. We've cloned animals. We've invented the television and the computer, and we've invented plastics and radar and the silicon chip. We've cured polio, cured smallpox. We've built airplanes, learned to fly them. We've built rockets. We've walked on the moon. It's unbelievable when you think of who we are and where we're from. This is a great country. But I'll tell you what, the country belongs to the American people. It has always belonged to the American people. That's what the United States Constitution says. We the people. Now, I told you I grew up in a town of 300 people. We had a blacksmith when I was a kid. There aren't many blacksmiths around, but I went down to see what a blacksmith did. I used to go down and watch him. He was dirty with soot and so on. And he would have this forge, and he'd heat up metal to white hot. And then he'd pound it. Plowshares, horseshoes. What I learned is that you actually can bend steel with heat. There's a lesson about that in politics as well. And remember it. Apply some heat. You can bend this government to your political will. That's what our Constitution understands and provides. The will of the people. One final point. I come from Western North Dakota. I told you we raised horses, some cattle, and I represent ranchers. I'm going to tell you how not to push the Congress. A rancher called me one day from Western North Dakota. I was sitting at my desk in the United States Senate, and he was furious with me. I don't even remember the issue, but he was upset. And he told me off, and then he said, "Let me tell you something, Dorgan." He said, "You either fix this problem, or by God, I'm coming down there to fix you." I said, "Are you trying to threaten me?" He said, "Hell yes, I thought I made that clear." So, wrong way to deal with the Congress. But let me again say to you tonight, on issues of media concentration, internet freedom, independent programming, and so many other issues, I'm inspired by the fact that you gather in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and decide that you want to do what American citizens have always done, and that's provide leadership to a great country. Thank you very much. God bless you.
Senator Byron Dorgan of North Dakota. Our final speaker will be Canadian journalist and author Naomi Klein.
Thank you, Liz. It's wonderful to be here. And it is an incredible day, evening, for this gathering to be taking place. I'm not endorsing any political candidate, but as you no doubt heard between panels today, Hillary Clinton officially withdrew from the race for Democratic Party nominee and endorsed Barack Obama. She endorsed Barack Obama. Now, whatever you think of Obama or the Democratic Party, and I say this quite seriously that I am not endorsing anyone, and I'm Canadian, this has to be recognized as at least a partial victory for the forces gathered here tonight. Progressives and online media overwhelmingly backing Obama over Clinton were proven right, and the corporate media struggling to play catch-up after their early Clinton coronation was proven wrong again and again. Now, what happened officially today is that the candidate of the establishment lost, and in the process, the grassroots in this country, particularly the media grassroots, grew and grew. Now, Obama's victory has been powered, as you know, by very real rage at the invasion and occupation of Iraq, at the abandonment of New Orleans, at U.S. unilateralism on the world stage, at the inequalities created by a 30-year campaign to dismantle the New Deal. This movement that has grown has stunned the clueless mainstream press, and it has proven how much further left American voters are than the so-called political pundits, who are about as good, it would seem, as reading the American mind as predicting the outcome of the disastrous invasion of Iraq. Now, the invasion of Iraq, I would argue, and I think many of you agree, and this really is the political significance of today's moment, is that Iraq was the decisive issue in the campaign. It was the one that voters returned to again and again. Clinton supported the war, Obama did not, and that matters. At long last, there has been some accountability for the people who started this disastrous war. What happened today is that somebody paid a price at last. It's not enough, but it's a beginning. It's a beginning. And it's thanks in large part to the media movements represented in this room that there was finally some accountability. And now, of course, the establishment is scrambling to assert control over Obama to make up for its early bad bet. This is entirely predictable. We would expect nothing less. But the question is this: what will the people who helped win his historic victory ask of Obama now? I hope that you will demand that he earn the incredible trust that he has been given. Because the hard truth is this: Obama may have the energy and the anger and the networks of the anti-war vote, but he does not have a plan to get us out of Iraq. What he has is a plan to downsize the occupation of Iraq, not to end it. He talks about keeping the green zone intact and calls that ending the war. Let me tell you, you cannot keep the green zone, which is the symbol of the foreign occupation of Iraq, without a massive troop presence that includes the military contractors like Blackwater as well. He may have the very real rage at the income inequality that has opened up in this country and around the world, but I am sad to say that he does not have a real plan to close that gap. And he may have the incredible, inspiring idealism of young environmentalists who are terrified about the future of this planet, but he does not have a green agenda that is a match to our climate crisis. So what is this moment that we feel, this confusing moment that we feel, that feels like a victory, only we're not sure, and we should listen to that skepticism. Because it's time to use the power in this room to do more than cheer for political candidates as if they are rock stars, as if they are candidates on a reality TV show. Our job is to tell the hard truth, and it is our job to push for the kind of radical change that can actually turn the political tide. We are in times of global crises. You don't need to tell me this, of serial crises, of crises layering on top of each other. Oil crises, food crises, housing crises, military and monetary crises. It is a time in this country when millions are turning to food stamps, are facing eviction from their homes, returning maimed from war. It's worth remembering that America has faced moments like this before, and those moments have produced some of the most important progressive victories in the history of this country. Now, I want to bring our minds back to another moment of profound crisis after the market crash of 1929. That was the moment that created the New Deal. Now, it didn't happen because FDR was a great guy. It happened because people in this country were so radicalized, were so determined, were so organized, that he was able to sell the New Deal to the elites as a compromise, because the alternative was revolution. I don't know if you support Barack Obama. I don't know if you support any candidate. But I can tell you this, that the greatest gift that you could give him would be the gift of being that kind of a threat. The gift that he could be able to say to the Wall Street players that have funded his campaign, look, I've got no choice. They're crazy out there. I've got to get us out of Iraq. I've got to protect Americans from foreclosure. I've got to create a Green New Deal because the credibility of the entire system is on the line. It's worth remembering the very special and important dynamics that created that process. The progressives of the 1930s drew energy from two key sources. They clearly saw the crisis as evidence of the failures of deregulated capitalism, the failures of laissez-faire economics. That's what created the crash. They had the correct diagnosis. They weren't afraid to make it. They also had their unshakable conviction in their own ideas, their own alternatives. And they had an unshakable belief that those ideas represented an end to the logic that had pushed so many into dire poverty so quickly. They declared an end to laissez-faire capitalism. Laissez-faire means let it be. We might call it stuff happens today. They wanted an activist government, one not afraid to do, to build, to plan, full employment. They did it through mass union drives, consumer organization, organizing students. They had this crazy idea. Their idea was that since Wall Street financiers had created the crisis, that de facto disqualified them from solving it. Now, the progressives of that era didn't think it was enough to get their candidate into office and relax. They knew they had to organize independent progressive movements to be a counterpower to the business lobby that was pushing from the other side. So yes, FDR brought in the New Deal, but he did so under enormous and continuous pressure from the grassroots. At the time, progressives, organized, were making demands that were far more radical than what they eventually got. They were asking for single-payer national health care. Upton Sinclair met with FDR, and he said to him, we don't want handouts. We don't want your charity. We want the tools of self-sufficiency. And he was calling for a mass campaign for workers' cooperatives across the country. Now, as you know, in my book, I write about disaster capitalism. This was something else. This was disaster collectivism. It was using a disaster to bring more people into the political process, build a deeper democracy. That was possible then. It's possible now. Now, it's helpful to remember this period for a couple of reasons. One, it reminds us that history is cyclical. Because for the past 30 years, we have been living a backlash against the New Deal and policies like it around the world. That's what this era since Reagan has been about. But the mood is turning, and the climate is ripe for a new wave of big, bold, creative thinking and solutions. But I'm also bringing this up because there is a real danger of thinking that all it takes is getting a right candidate in the White House. And that, in fact, as you all know, is only the beginning. The weapons and so-called reconstruction companies, the ones who profit most from a continued presence in Iraq, have been getting very nervous about the possibility of a Democratic victory. And this is the first election cycle in 14 years that the Democrats have gotten more money from the arms industry than the Republicans. In 1994, the Democrats got 32% of the donations from the weapons companies. This year, they got 52%. Now, we know that the Democratic candidates, all of them, have been getting huge pressure from these corporations, and they've been getting very little more than cheerleading from their supporters, and that strategy simply doesn't work. Because we can't make this mistake. If we don't demand the kind of change that we want, it will not happen. We have to fight for this world that we want. We have to make the concrete policy demands. We have to push whichever candidate we believe in. Just as the weapons companies, the oil and gas companies, the agribusiness companies will be pushing them from the other side. This is a war. Make no mistake. The disaster capitalists are organized and focused. If we want to challenge their disastrous vision of the world, one in which every new crisis is an opportunity to segregate us further and make record profits, we have to tackle their logic head on. Now, the good news is this. When we work for peace and environmental sustainability, we don't just end the senseless killing abroad. We take our planet off of its disastrous course. We free up money to invest in people. In other words, we take away their market. Because without a steady stream of crises and disasters, the disaster capitalists are out of a job. Now, history is not made by great men. It's worth remembering this today on this great day. It is made in the space between the space that opens up when those in power realize that they are more vulnerable than they think, and when those who have been told again and again that they are powerless find new reserves of power. Thank you.
Canadian journalist and author Naomi Klein. You've been listening to a small selection of the many speakers at the National Conference on Media Reform that wrapped up today, Sunday, June 8th, in Minneapolis, organized by Free Press. You can get connected to Free Press and the media reform movement on the still free internet at freepress.net. Thanks once again for listening to this edition of Unwelcome Guests, which can be downloaded as an MP3 at unwelcomeguests.org.
First he told Sony, through you could we know God, and if we dared to question, then he wouldn't spare the rod. For you we worked the soil, for you we dug the moors, for you we shed our blood, fought so many pointless wars. And now you build your fences, and you say there's nothing we can do. You say the world around us belongs fairly to the few. But about 6 billion people no doubt will agree this world is our home, not your property. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you would enclose the land all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. With our sweat we built the railroads, built cities on these shores. But because you own the money, you say that it's all yours. We laid the phone lines and the pipelines, and then right before our eyes, you see these things our taxes paid for, you now will privatize. Privatize the hospitals, privatize the schools, privatize the prisons for all those who break your rules. And preparing for the day when all the wells run dry, you say you own the very rain that falls down from the sky. But it's the commons, our right of birth. And you'd own the water all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public good for your private gain. You claim to own the harvest with your Terminator seeds. You claim to own the genomes of every animal that breeds. You claim to own our culture and the music that we play. And with each song that we download, to your coffers we must pay. You'd even own my name, and yet say it's for the best. Maybe you'll let us on your radio if our songs can pass your test. You own country, you own Western, you say you've given us a choice. You may own the airwaves, but you'll never own my voice. It's the commons, our right of birth. And you'd own the music all around the earth. Our future is your downfall when we cut this ball and chain. You who'd sacrifice the public.